Is there a desire in you to not just attend revival, but live in revival? Welcome to the Revival Lifestyle Podcast. I'm your host, Isaiah Saldivar. I've been in revival for the last 10 years, as well as traveling and being a part of many revivals throughout the United States. I'm going to be sharing with you how to live a radical lifestyle of revival on a daily basis. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're on day number 37, right? Right, everybody? Day number 37? Yes. Yes, yes, of course we are. I already knew that. I didn't have to check my phone. Day 37 of our Bible in 90 days. Thank you all for being here, loading up in the chat, sharing the broadcast, liking the broadcast. Type 1 when you can hear me, when you can see me. All right, here we go. Esther chapter 1. We are there. No long intro. We're getting right into it. So we're going to Job today too, which is going to be good. All right, Esther chapter 1, the king's banquet. These events happened in the days of King Xerxes, who reigned over 127 provinces stretching from India to Ethiopia. At that time, Xerxes ruled his empire from his royal throne at the fortress of Susa. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. He invited all the military officers of Persia and Media, as well as the princes and nobles of the provinces. There's no way I'm pronouncing that right. The celebration lasted 180 days. That right there is a party. 180 days? Wow. A tremendous display of the opulent wealth of his empire and the pomp and splendor of his majesty. When it was all over, the king gave a banquet for all the people, from the greatest to the least, who were in the fortress of Susa. It lasted for 7 days and was held in the courtyard of the palace garden. The courtyard was beautifully decorated with white cotton curtains and blue hangings, which were fastened with white linen cords and purple ribbons to silver rings embedded in marble pillars. Gold and silver couches stood on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Mother of pearl. Drinks were served in gold goblets of many designs, and there was an abundance of royal wine, reflecting the king's generosity. By edict of the king, no limits were placed on the drinking, for the king had instructed all his palace officials to serve each man as much as he wanted. At the same time, Queen Vashti gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day of the feast, King Xerxes was in high spirits because of the wine, aka he was drunk. He told the seven eunuchs who attended him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbana, Bigtha, Abigtha, Zether, and Carcass, to bring Queen Vashti to him with the royal crown on her head. He wanted the nobles and all the other men to gaze on her beauty, for she was a very beautiful woman. But when they conveyed the king's order to Queen Vashti, she refused to come. This made the king furious, and he burned with anger. He immediately consulted with his wife's advisors, who knew all the Persian laws and customs, for he always asked their advice. The names of these men were Kashanas, Shether, Admatha. All right. They met with the king regularly and held the highest positions in the empire. Verse 15. What must be done to Queen Vashti? The king demanded. What penalty does the law provide for a queen who refuses to obey the king's orders, properly sent through his eunuchs? Menachem answered the king and his nobles. Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also every noble and citizen throughout your empire. Women everywhere will begin to despise their husbands when they learn that Queen Vashti has refused to appear before the king. Before this day is out, the wives of all the king's nobles throughout Persia and Media will hear that the king did and will start treating their husbands the same way. There'll be no end to their contempt and anger. So if it pleases the king, we suggest that you issue a warning, a written decree, a law of the Persians and Medes that cannot be revoked. It should order that Queen Vashti be forever banished from the presence of King Xerxes, and that the king should choose another queen more worthy than she. When this decree is published through the king's empire, husbands everywhere, whatever their rank, will receive proper respect from their wives. The king and his nobles thought this made good sense, so he followed Memucan's counsel. He sent letters to all parts of the empire to each province in his own script and language, proclaiming that every man should be the ruler of his own home and should say whatever he pleases. Wow, okay. Chapter 2, Esther becomes queen. But after Xerxes' anger had subsided, he began thinking about Vashti and what she had done and the decree he had made. So his personal attendant suggested, "Let us search the empire to find young, beautiful virgins for the king. Let the king appoint agents in each province to bring these beautiful young women into the royal harem of the fortress of Susa. Haggai, the king's eunuch in charge of the harem, will see it that they are all given beauty treatments. After that, This is just perverted. The young woman who most pleased the king will be made queen instead of Vashti. This advice was very appealing to the king, so he put the plan into effect. At that time, there was a Jewish man in the fortress of Susa whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair. He was from the tribe of Benjamin and was descendant of Kish and Shimeah. His family had been among those who, with King Jehoiakim of Judah, had been exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. This man had a very beautiful wife. Oh, wait. This man had a very beautiful, how did I get the word wife? And lovely young cousin, Hadassah, who was also called Esther. When her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her in the family and raised her as his own daughter. As a result of the king's decree, Esther, along with many of the other young women, was brought to the king's harem at the fortress of Susa, placed in Haggai's care. Haggai was very impressed with Esther and treated her kindly. He quickly ordered a special menu for her and provided her with beauty treatments. He also assigned her 7 maids, specially chosen from the king's palace, and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Esther had not told anyone of her nationality and family background, because Mordecai had directed her not to do so. Every day, Mordecai would take, a walk near the courtyard of the harem to find out about Esther and what was happening to her. But each young woman was taken to the king's bed. She was given the prescribed 12 months of beauty treatments. 6 months with oil of myrrh, followed by 6 months with special perfumes and ointments. Wow, that's crazy. When it was time for her to go to the king's palace, she was given her choice of whatever clothing or jewelry she wanted to take from the harem. That evening, she was taken to the king's private room, and the next morning, she was brought to the second harem. Is that harem? Am I saying that right? Let me know in the chat. Where the king's wives lived. There she would be under the care of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, in charge of the concubines. He would never go to the king unless he had especially enjoyed her and requested her by name. Wait, what? She would never go to the queen, unless he requested... Okay. Esther was the daughter of Abihail, who was Mordecai's uncle. When it was Esther's turn to go to the king, she accepted the advice of Haggai, the eunuch in charge of the harem. She asked for nothing except what he suggested. Then she was admired by everyone who saw her. Esther was taken to King Xerxes at the royal palace in early winter on the 7th year of his reign, and the king loved Esther more than any other of the young women. He was so delighted with her that he set the royal crown on her head and declared her queen instead of Vashti. To celebrate the occasion, he gave a great banquet in Esther's honor with all his nobles and officials, declaring a public holiday for the province and giving generous gifts to everyone. Even after all the young women had been transferred to the second harem, Mordecai had become a palace official, Esther continued to keep her family background and nationality a secret. She was still following Mordecai's directions, just as she did when she lived in his home. One day, as Mordecai was on duty at the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthana and Teresh, were guards at the door of the king's private quarters, became angry at King Xerxes and plotted to assassinate him. But Mordecai heard about the plot and gave the information to Queen Esther. She told the king about it and gave Mordecai credit for the report. When an investigation was made and Mordecai's story was found to be true, the two men were impaled on a sharpened pole. This was all recorded in the book of the history of King Xerxes' reign. Chapter 3. Haman's Plot Against the Jews. Sometime later, King Xerxes promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, over all the nobles, making him the most powerful official in the empire. All the king's officials would bow down before Haman to show him respect whenever he passed by, for the king had commanded, but Mordecai refused to bow down or show him respect. Then the palace officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why are you disobeying the king's command?" They spoke to him day after day, but he still refused to comply with the order. So they spoke to Haman about this to see if he would tolerate Mordecai's conduct, since Mordecai had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not bow down or show him respect, he was filled with rage. He had learned of Mordecai's nationality, so he decided it was not enough to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Instead, he looked for a way to destroy all the Jews throughout the entire empire of Xerxes. So in the month of April, during the 12th year of King Xerxes' reign, lots were cast in Haman's presence to determine the best day of the month to take action. And the day selected was March 7th, early next year, nearly a year later. When Haman approached King Xerxes and said, "There's a certain race of people scattered all through the province of your empire who keep themselves separate from everyone else. Their laws are different from those of any other people, and they refuse to obey the laws of the king. So it is not the king's interest to let them live. If it please the king, issue a decree that they may be destroyed, and I will give 10,000 large sacks of silver to the government administrators to be deposited in the royal treasury." The king agreed, confirming his decision by removing his signet ring from his finger and giving it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agai, the enemy of the Jews. The king said, "The money and the people are both yours to do with as you see fit." So on April 17th, the king's secretaries were summoned and the decree was written exactly as Haman dictated. He was sent to the king's highest officers, the governors of the respective provinces, and nobles of each province in their own scripts and languages. The decree was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring. Dispatches were sent by swift messengers into all the provinces of the empire, giving the order that all the Jews, young and old, including women and children, must be killed, slaughtered, and annihilated on a single day. This was scheduled to happen on March 7th of the next year. The property of the Jews would be given to those who killed them. Wow, that's so sad. A copy of this decree was to be issued in law in every province and proclaimed to all the people so they would be ready to go and on duty on the appointed day. At the king's command, the decree would go out in swift messengers. It was also proclaimed in the fortress of Susa. Then the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa fell into confusion. Chapter 4. When Mordecai learned about all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on burlap and ashes and went out into the city, crying with a loud and bitter wail. He went as far as the gate of the palace, for no one was allowed to enter the palace gate while wearing clothes of mourning. And as news of the king's decree reached all the provinces, there was great mourning among the Jews. They fasted, wept, and wailed, and many lay in burlap and ashes. When Queen Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was deeply distressed. She sent clothing to him to replace the burlap, but he refused it. Then Esther sent for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed as her attendant. She ordered him to go to Mordecai and find out what was troubling him and why he was in mourning. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the square in front of the palace gate. Mordecai told him the whole story, including the exact amount of money that Haman promised to pay in the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai gave Hathach a copy of the decree issued in Susa that called the death of all Jews. He asked Hathach to show it to Esther and explain the situation to her. He also asked Hathach to direct her to go to the king, beg for mercy, and plead for her people. So Hathach returned to Esther with Mordecai's message. Then Esther told Hathach to go back and relay this message to Mordecai. All the king's officials and even the people in the provinces know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless the king holds out his gold scepter. And the king has not called for me to come to him for 30 days. So Hathach gave Esther his message to Mordecai. Mordecai sent this reply. Don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace, you'll escape when all the other Jews are killed. If you keep quiet, this is a word, preach this, brother, I have before. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die. This is one of my favorite verses in the Bible. And who knows, perhaps you were made queen for such a time as this. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go and gather together all the Jews of Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will do the same. And then, though it's against the law, I will go in to see the king. If I must die, I must die. So Mordecai went and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Chapter 5. On the third day of the fast, Esther put on her royal robes and entered the inner court of the palace, just across from the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne, facing the entrance. When he saw Queen Esther standing there in the inner court, he welcomed her and held out his gold scepter to her. So Esther approached him and touched the end of the scepter. Then the king said, "What do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? I'll give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom." And Esther replied, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a banquet I've prepared for the king." The king turned to his attendant and said, "Tell Haman to come quickly to a banquet, as Esther has requested." So the king and Haman went to Esther's banquet. And while they were drinking wine, the king said to Esther, "Now tell me what you really want. What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom." Esther replied, "This is my request and deepest wish. If I found favor with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request and do what I ask, please come with Haman tomorrow to the banquet. I'll prepare for you. Then I'll explain what it's all about." Haman was a happy man as he left the banquet. But when he saw Mordecai sitting at the palace gate, not standing up or trembling or nervous before him, Haman became furious. However, he restrained himself and went on home. Then Haman gathered together his friends and Zeresh his wife and boasted to them about his great wealth and his many children. He bragged about the honors the king had given him and how he had been promoted over all the nobles and officials. Then Haman added, "That's not all. Queen Esther invited only me and the king himself to the banquet she prepared for us, and she invited me to dine with her and the king again tomorrow." Then he added, "But this is all worth nothing as long as Mordecai the Jew is just sitting there at the palace gate." So Haman's wife, Zeresh, and all his friends suggested, "Set up a sharpened pole and stand 75 feet tall, and in the morning ask the king to impale Mordecai on it." These people are so wicked. Who thinks of that? "When this is done, you can go on your merry way to the banquet with the king." This pleased Haman, and he ordered the pole set up. Chapter 6. Yeah. That night, the king had trouble sleeping, so he ordered an attendant to bring the book of history of his reign so it could be read to him. He's just casually reading his own history. In those records, he discovered an account of how Mordecai had exposed the plot of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the eunuchs who had guarded the door to the king's private quarters. They had plotted to assassinate King Xerxes. "What reward or recognition do we ever give Mordecai for this?" the king said. His attendant said, "Nothing has been done for him." "Who was in the outer court?" the king inquired. As it happened, Haman had just arrived in the outer court of the palace to ask the king to impale Mordecai in the pole he had prepared. So the attendants replied, Haman is out in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. So Haman came in and the king said, what should I do to honor the man who truly pleases me? Haman thought to himself, whom would the king wish to honor more than me? So he replied, if the king wishes to honor someone, he should bring out one of the king's own royal robes, as well as the horse the king himself has ridden, one with the royal emblem on its head. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials, and let him see it that the man whom the king wishes to honor is dressed in the king's robe and led through the city square on the king's horse. Have the officials shout as they go, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. Excellent, the king said to Haman. Quick, take the robes of my horse and do just as you said to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the gate of the palace. Leave nothing you have suggested. So Haman, remember Haman's trying to kill Mordecai, took the robes and put them on Mordecai, placed him on the king's own horse, and led him through the city square shouting, this is what the king does for someone he wishes to honor. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the palace gate, but Haman hurried home, dejected and completely humiliated. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends what had happened, his wise advisors and his wife said, since Mordecai, this man who has humiliated you, is of Jewish birth, you'll never succeed in your plans against him. It'll be fatal to continue opposing him. While they were still talking, the king's eunuchs arrived and quickly took Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. Chapter 7. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. On the second occasion, while they were drinking wine, the king again said to Esther, tell me what you want, Queen Esther. What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it's half the kingdom. Queen Esther replied, if I found favor in the king and if it pleases the king to grant my request, I ask that my life and the lives of my people be spared. For my people and I have been sold to those who had killed, slaughtered, and annihilated us. We had merely been sold as slaves. I could remain quiet, for that would have been trivial a matter to warrant disturbing the king. Who would do such a thing? Xerxes demanded. Who would be so presumptuous to touch you? Esther replied, this wicked Haman is our advisor and our enemy. Haman grew pale with fright before the king and queen. Then the king jumped to his feet in a rage and went out into the palace garden. Haman, however, stayed behind to plead for his life with Queen Esther, for he knew the king intended to kill him. In despair, he fell on the couch where Queen Esther was reclining, just as the king was returning from the palace garden. The king said, will you even assault the queen right here in the palace before my eyes? And as soon as the king spoke, his attendants covered Haman's face, signaling his doom. Then Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, said, Haman has set up a sharp pole that stands 75 feet tall in his own courtyard. He intended to use it to impale Mordecai, the man who saved the king from the assassination. Then impale Haman on it, the king ordered. So they impaled Haman on the pole that had been set up for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Ugh. I don't know if you guys know what being impaled is, but it's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. Terrible way to die. Terrible. Chapter 8, a decree to help the Jews. On the same day King Xerxes gave the property of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther, then Mordecai was brought before the king. Esther had told the king how they were related. The king took off his signet ring, which had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai to be in charge of Haman's property. Then Esther went again before the king, falling down at his feet and begging him with tears to stop the evil plot devised by Haman the Agagite against the Jews. Again, the king held out a gold scepter to Esther. So she rose and stood before him. Esther said, if it pleases the king and I found favor with him, and if he thinks it's right and if I'm pleasing to him, let there be a decree that reverses the orders of Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, who ordered the Jews throughout all the provinces should be destroyed. For how can I endure to see my people and my family slaughtered and destroyed? Then King Xerxes said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, I've given Esther the property of Haman, and he has been impaled on a pole because he tried to destroy the Jews. Now go ahead and send a message to the Jews in the king's name, telling them whatever you want, and seal it with the king's signet ring. But remember that whatever has already been written in the king's name and sealed with a signet can never be revoked. So on June 25th, the king's secretaries were summoned, and a decree was written exactly as Mordecai dictated. It was sent to all the Jews and to the highest officers, the governors, and the nobles of all 127 provinces stretching from India to Ethiopia. The decree was written in the scripts and languages of all the people of the empire, including that of the Jews. The decree was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring. Mordecai sent the dispatches by swift messengers who rode fast horses, especially bred for the king's service. The king's decree gave the Jews in every city authority to defend their lives. They were allowed to kill, slaughter, and annihilate any nationality or province who might attack them or their children or wives or take their property. The day chosen for this event throughout all the province of King Xerxes was March 7th of the next year. A copy of this decree was to be issued as a law in every province and proclaimed to all people so the Jews would be ready to take revenge on their enemies on the appointed day. So the urge on by the king's command, the messengers rode out swiftly on fast horses bred for the king's service. The same decree was also proclaimed in the fortress of Susa. Then Mordecai left the king's presence, wearing the royal robe of blue and white and great crown of gold, and on an outer cloak of fine linen and purple. And the people of Susa celebrated the new decree. The Jews were filled with joy and gladness and were honored everywhere. In every province and city, wherever the king's decree arrived, the Jews rejoiced and had a great celebration and declared a public festival and holiday. And many of the people of the land became Jews themselves, for they feared what the Jews might do to them. Chapter 9. So on March 7th, the two decrees of the king were put into effect. On that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but quite the opposite happened. It was the Jews who overpowered their enemies. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the king's provinces to attack anyone who tried to harm them, but no one would make a stand against them, for everyone was afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the highest officers, the governors, and the royal officials helped the Jews for fear of Mordecai. For Mordecai had been promoted in the king's palace, and his fame spread through all the provinces as he became more and more powerful. So the Jews went ahead on the appointed day and struck down their enemies with a sword. They killed and annihilated their enemies and did as they pleased of those who hated them. In the fortress of Susa itself, the Jews killed 500 men. They also killed Parshandatha, Dalphon, and Aspatha, Paratha, Adalia, Aradoth. Okay, names. The 10 sons of Haman, son of the enemy of the Jews, but they did not take any plunder. The very day the king was informed of the number of people killed in the fortress of Susa, he called for Queen Esther. He said, "The Jews have killed 500 men in the fortress of Susa alone, as well as Haman's 10 sons. If they've done that here, what has happened in the rest of the provinces? But now, what more do you want? It'll be granted to you. Tell me and I'll do it." Esther responded, "If it pleases the king, give the Jews in Susa permission to do it again tomorrow, as they've done today, and let the bodies of Haman's 10 sons be impaled on a pole." Yeah, nasty. So the king agreed, and the decree was announced in Susa, and they impaled the bodies of Haman's 10 sons. Then Jews at Susa gathered on March 8th and killed 300 more men, and they took again no plunder. Meanwhile, the other Jews throughout the king's province had gathered together to defend their lives. They gained relief from all their enemies, killing 75,000 of those who hated them, but they did not take any plunder. This was done throughout the provinces on March 7th, and on March 8th they rested, celebrating their victory with a day of feasting and gladness. So to this day, rural Jews living in remote villages celebrate the annual festival and holiday on the appointed day in late winter, when they rejoice and send gifts and food to each other. Mordecai recorded these events and sent letters to the Jews, near and far, throughout all the provinces of King Xerxes, calling all of them to celebrate an annual festival on these days. He told them to celebrate days with feasting and gladness, and by giving out food to each other and presents to the poor. This would commemorate a time when the Jews gained relief from their enemies, when their sorrow turned into gladness, and when their mourning into joy. So the Jews accepted Mordecai's proposal and adopted this annual custom. Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had plotted to crush and destroy them on the date determined by casting lots. But when Esther came before the king, he issued a decree causing Haman's plot to backfire, and Haman and his sons were impaled on a sharpened pole. The celebration is called Purim, because it's the ancient word for casting lots. So because of Mordecai's letter and because of what they had experienced, the Jews throughout the realm agreed to inaugurate this tradition and to pass it on their descendants and all who became Jews. They declared that they would never fail to celebrate these two prescribed days as the appointed time each year. These days would have been remembered and kept from generation to generation and celebrated by every family throughout the provinces and the cities of the empire. The festival of Purim would never cease to be celebrated among the Jews, nor would the memory of what happened ever die out among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, along with the Mordecai the Jew, wrote another letter putting the queen's full authority behind Mordecai's letter to establish the festival of Purim. Letters wishing peace and security were sent out to the Jews out to the 127 provinces of the Empire of Xerxes. These letters established the festival of Purim, an annual celebration of these days at the appointed time, decreed by both Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther. The people decided to observe this festival just as they decided themselves and their descendants to establish both times of fasting and mourning. So the command of Esther confirmed the practice of Purim, and it was all written down in the records. Chapter 10. King Xerxes imposed a tribute throughout the empire, even to the distant coastlands. His great achievements and full account of the greatness of Mordecai, whom the king had promoted, are recorded in the book of history of the kings of Media and Persia. Mordecai the Jew became the prime minister with authority next to that of King Xerxes himself. He was very great among the Jews, who held him in high esteem because he continued to work for the good of his people and to speak up for the welfare of their descendants. All right, we did it. We are done with Esther. We are now in the book of Job. All right, let me get a drink of water. Take a little water break, and we are going to start Job. Type one in the chat if you're still here. Here we go. I don't know what chapter we're going to, but we will find out because I highlighted where we're ending. Job chapter 1. Interestingly, this was the first, or this is the oldest book in the Bible. So if you're reading like a Bible written, or a Bible in the order of when it was written, Job would be the first book. It was the oldest book. There was one, not that it was the very, you know, earliest man, but it was the first book written. There was once a man named Job who lived in the land of Uz. He was a blameless man of complete integrity. He feared God and stayed away from evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. He owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 teams of oxen, and 500 female donkeys. He also had many servants. He was, in fact, the richest person in that entire area. Job's son would take turns preparing feasts in their homes, and they would also invite their 3 sisters to celebrate with them. When the celebration ended, sometimes after several days, Job would purify his children. He would get up early in the morning and offer a burnt offering for each of them. For Job said to himself, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular practice. One day, the members of the heavenly court came to present themselves before the Lord. The accuser, Satan, came with them. So that Satan literally came to the throne of God. "Where have you come from?" the Lord asked Satan. Satan answered the Lord, "I've been patrolling the earth, watching everything that's going on." Then the Lord asked Satan, "Have you noticed my servant Job? He's the finest man." I preached a whole sermon on this, so I'm going to struggle not to preach this because I want to make points every point. But interesting that God brought up Job's name to the devil. "He's the finest man in all the earth." Imagine God saying this about you. This is amazing for God to say this about you. "He's the finest man in all the earth. He is blameless, a man of complete integrity. He fears God and stays away from evil." Satan replied to the Lord, "Yes, but Job has a good reason to fear God. You have always put a wall of protection around him and his home and his property. You have made him prosper in everything he does. Look how rich he is. But reach out and take everything he has, and he'll surely curse you to your face." "All right, you may test him," the Lord said to Satan. "Do whatever you want with everything he possesses, but don't harm him physically." So Satan left the Lord's presence. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting at the older brother's house, a messenger arrived at Job's home with the news. "Your oxen were plowing with the donkeys feeding beside them. When the Sabians raided us, they stole all the animals and killed all the farmhands. I'm the only one who escaped to tell you." While he was speaking, another messenger arrived with this news. "The fire of God has fallen from heaven and burned up your sheep and all your shepherds. I'm the only one who escaped to tell you." While he was speaking, a third messenger arrived. "3 bands of Chaldean raiders have stolen your camels and killed your servants. I'm the only one who escaped to tell you." While he was speaking, another messenger arrived with this news. "Your sons and daughters were feasting in their oldest brother's home, and suddenly a powerful wind swept in from the wilderness and hit the house on all sides. The house collapsed and all of your children are dead. I'm the only one who escaped to tell you." Job stood up. This is like the worst possible thing ever. You've lost everything in just an instant. Job stood up and tore his robe in grief. Then he shaved his head and fell to the ground to worship. He said, "I came naked from my mother's womb, and I will be naked when I leave. The Lord gave me what I had, and the Lord has taken it away. Praise the name of the Lord." Wow. That's intense. Powerful. In all of this, Job did not sin by blaming God. Oh, so it's a sin to blame God for the stuff happening in your life. Don't do that. Chapter 2, Job's second test. One day, the members of the heavenly court came again to present themselves before the Lord, and the accuser, Satan, came with them. "Where have you come from?" the Lord asked Satan. Satan answered, "I've been patrolling the earth, watching everything that's going on." Then the Lord asked Satan, did we already read this? Hold on. Oh, no. Okay. There's a second. I didn't realize it does it again. "He's a blameless man of complete integrity. He fears God and stays away from evil, and he's maintained his integrity even though you urge me to harm him without cause." Satan replied to the Lord, "Skin for skin, a man will give up everything he has to save his life. But reach out and take away his health, and he'll surely curse you to your face." Oh, yeah, I forgot about this. "All right, do with him as you please," the Lord said to Satan, "but spare his life." So Satan left the Lord's presence, and he struck Job with a terrible boil from head to foot. Job scraped his skin with a piece of broken pottery as he sat among the ashes. His wife said, "Are you still trying to maintain your integrity with God? Curse God and die." But Job said, "You talk like a foolish woman. Should we accept only good things from the hand of God and never anything bad?" Oh, that's powerful. That's a word for somebody. So in all this, Job said nothing wrong. Job's 3 friends share his anguish. Okay, it's a long book here, but his friends are going to be talking a lot here. When 3 of Job's friends heard of the tragedy he had suffered, they got together and traveled from their homes to comfort and console him. Their names were Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Namathite. When they saw Job from a distance, they scarcely recognized him. Wailing loudly, they tore their robes and threw dust into the air over their heads to show their grief. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and nights, and no one said a word to Job, for they saw his suffering was too great for words. Chapter 3, Job's first speech. At last, Job spoke. So this is after what? 7 days he hasn't spoke. And he cursed the day of his birth. He said, "Let the day of my birth be erased and the night I was conceived. Let the day be turned to darkness. Let the loss be even to God on high. Let it be a loss to even God on high and let no light shine on it. Let the darkness and utter gloom claim the day that for its own. Let a black cloud overshadow it and let the darkness terrify it. Let that night be blotted out of the calendar, never again to be counted among the days of the year, never again to appear among the months. Let that night be childless. Let it have no joy. Let those who are experts at cursing, those who cursing, whose cursing could rouse Leviathan, curse that day. Let this its morning stars remain dark and let it hope for light, but in vain. May it never see the morning light." And he's talking about the day he was born. "Curse that day for failing to shut my mother's womb, for letting me be born to see all this trouble. Why wasn't I born dead? Why didn't I die when I came from the womb? Why was I laid on my mother's lap? Why did she nurse me at her breast? Why didn't I die at birth? I would now be at peace. I would be asleep and at rest. I would rest with the world's kings and prime ministers whose great buildings now lie in ruins. I would rest with princes rich in gold whose palaces are filled with silver. Why wasn't I buried like a stillborn child, like a baby who never lives to see the light? For in death the wicked cause no trouble and in weary are at rest. Even captives are at ease in death with no guards to curse them. Rich and poor are both there and the slave is free from his master. Oh, why give light to those in misery and give life to those who are bitter? They long for death, but it won't come. They search for death more eagerly than a hidden treasure." This guy's quite the poet. "They're filled with joy when they finally die and rejoice when they find the grave. Why is life given to those who have no future, those whose gods surround them with difficulties? I cannot eat for sighing. My groans pour out like water. What I always feared has happened to me. What I dreaded has come true. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest. Only trouble comes." Ooh, that's dark. Chapter 4, Eliphaz's first response to Job. Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied to Job, "Will you be patient and let me say a word? For who could keep from speaking out? In the past, you've encouraged many people. You've strengthened those who are weak. Your words have supported those who are falling, and you encourage those with shaky knees. But now when trouble strikes, you lose heart. You're terrified when it touches you. Doesn't your reverence for God give you confidence? Doesn't your life of integrity give you hope? Stop and think. Do the innocent die when the upright have been destroyed? My experience shows that only those who plant trouble and cultivate evil will harvest the same. A breath from God destroys them. They vanish in a blast of his anger. The lion roars and the wildcat snarls, but the teeth of the strong lions will be broken. The fierce lion will starve for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness will be scattered. The truth was given to me in secret as though whispered in my ear. It came to me in a disturbing vision at night when the people were in a deep sleep. Fear gripped me and my bones trembled. A spirit swept past my face and my hair stood on end. The spirit stopped, but I couldn't see its shape. There was a form before my eyes. In the silence, I heard a voice say, 'Can a mortal be innocent before God? Can anyone be pure before the Creator? If God does not trust his own angels and has charged his messengers with foolishness, how much more will he trust people made of clay, or much less? They are made of dust, crushed as easily as a moth. They are alive in the morning, but dead by evening, gone forever without a trace. Their tent cords are pulled and the tent collapses and they die in ignorance.'" Eliphaz's response continues, chapter 5. "Cry for help, but will anyone answer you? Which of the angels will help you? Surely resentment destroys the fool, and jealousy kills the simple. I've seen that fools may be successful for the moment, but then comes sudden disaster." This is like Proverbs. "Their children are abandoned far from help. They are crushed in their court with no one to defend them. The hungry devour their harvest, even though it's guarded by brambles. The thirsty pant after wealth, but evil does not spring forth from soil, and trouble does not sprout from the earth. People are born for trouble as readily as sparks fly up from a fire. If I were you, I would go to God and present my case to him. He does great things too marvelous to understand. He performs countless miracles. He gives rain for the earth and water for the fields. He gives prosperity to the poor and protects those who suffer. He frustrates the plans of the schemers so the work of their hands will not succeed. He traps the wise in their own cleverness, so the cunning schemes are thwarted. They find dark in the night daytime, and they grope at noon if it were night. He rescues the poor from the cutting words of the strong and rescues from the clutches of the powerful. And so at last the poor have hope, and the snapping jaws of the wicked are shut. But consider the joy of those corrected by God. Do not despise the discipline of the Almighty when you sin." So they're implying that Job's in sin, even though obviously we know he's not. "For though he wounds, he also bandages. He strikes, but he also heals. From 6 disasters, he'll rescue you. Even the 7th, he'll keep you from evil. He'll save you from death in the time of famine, from the power of the sword in the time of war. You will be safe from slander and will have no fear when destruction comes. You'll laugh at destruction and famine, and wild animals will not terrify you. You'll be at peace with the stones of the field, and wild animals will be at peace with you. You'll know that your home is safe, and when you survey your possessions, nothing will be missing. You'll have many children. Your descendants will be as plentiful as grass. You'll go to the grave at a ripe old age, like a sheaf of grain harvested at the proper time. We've studied life and found all this to be true. Listen to my counsel and apply it for yourself. To yourself. All right, Job's second speech, a response to Eliphaz. Okay, so Job talked, his friend talked, now Job's going to respond to his friend. Then Job spoke again. If my misery could be weighed and my troubles be put on scales, they would outweigh all the sands of the sea. That is why I spoke impulsively. For the mighty has struck me down with his arrows. Their poison infects my spirit. God's terrors are lined up against me. Don't I have a right to complain? Don't wild donkeys bray when they find no grass and oxen bellow when they have no food? Don't people complain about insulted food? Does anyone want tasteless white of an egg? My appetite disappears when I look at it. I gag at the thought of eating it. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant my desire. I wish he would crush me. I wish he would reach out his hand and kill me. At last, I can take comfort in this. Despite the pain, I have not denied the words of the Holy One, but I don't have the strength to endure. I have nothing to live for. Do I have strength of a stone? Is my body made of bronze? No, I'm utterly helpless without any chance of success. One should be kind to a fainting friend, but you accuse me without any fear of the Almighty. My brothers, you've proved as unreliable as a seasonal brook that overflows its bank in spring, when it's swollen with ice and melting snow. But when the hot weather arrives, the water disappears, the brook vanishes in the heat. The caravanners turn aside to be refreshed, but there's nothing to drink, so they die. The caravans from Temu search for this water. The travelers from Sheba hope to find it. They count on it, but are disappointed. When they arrive, their hopes are dashed. You too have given no help. You've seen my calamity and you're afraid, but why? Have I asked you for a gift? Have I begged you for anything of yours for myself? Have I asked you to rescue me from my enemies or to save me from ruthless people? Teach me and I'll keep quiet. Show me what I've done wrong. Honest words can be painful, but what do your criticisms amount to? Do you think your words are convincing when you disregard my cry of desperation? You would even send an orphan into slavery or sell a friend. Look at me. Would I lie to your face? Stop assuming my guilt, for I've done no wrong. Do you think I'm lying? Don't I know the difference between right and wrong? It's not all human life a struggle. Chapter 7. It's not all human life a struggle. Our lives are like that of a hired hand, like workers who long for the shade, like a servant waiting to be paid. I, too, have been assigned months of futility, long and weary nights of misery. Lying in bed, I think, when will it be morning? But the night drags on and I toss till dawn. This is so sad. Like, I've had the flu once and felt this way. But, I mean, this is just way worse than the flu. My body is covered with maggots and scabs. Okay, yeah, way worse than the flu. And my skin breaks open, oozing with pus. Ugh. Nasty. Job cries out to God. My days fly faster than a weaver's shuttle. They end without hope. Oh God, remember that my life is but a breath. And I'll never again feel happiness. You see, this is kind of depressing, I'm not going to lie. You see me now, but not for long. You'll look for me, but I will be gone. Just as a cloud dissipates and vanishes, those who die, I'll not come back. They are gone forever from their home, never to be seen again. I cannot keep from speaking. I must express my anguish. My bitter soul must complain. Am I a sea monster or a dragon that you must place me under guard? I think my bed will comfort me and sleep will erase my misery, but then you shatter me with dreams and terrify me with visions. I would rather be strangled, rather die than suffer like this. I hate my life and I don't want to go on living. Oh, leave me alone for a few remaining days. What are people that you should make us so that you should make so much of us that you should think of us so often? For you examine us every morning and you test us every moment. Why won't you leave me alone, at least long enough for me to swallow? If I've sinned, what have I done to you, O watcher of all humanity? Why make me your target? Am I a burden to you? Why not just forgive my sin and take away my guilt? For soon I will lie down in the dust and die, and you'll look for me and I'll be gone. Wow, that is heavy, 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 strong words there from Job. All right. That concludes our reading of today. If you don't know, I've said this before, I pre-record almost every Sunday, which today is obviously Sunday, because I'm at church right now. So go to church, go to lunch with your family, have some fun, hang out, and all that good stuff. Thank you guys for joining us once again. I love you all. I will be live again tomorrow at 2 o'clock. You can support us with the link on the screen. You can give on the description. All of our content is free. We're doing this every day for free. It's viewer supported, so we survive based on support. Also, don't forget I have a book, How to Cast Out Demons. Everything you need to know about deliverance. This is literally a deliverance handbook. If you want to know how to do deliverance, practical steps, this is the book for you. It's an all-in-one guide. Everything you need to know. I've read a lot of deliverance books, and I just wrote one that has everything you need in it. So Please purchase that down below in the description. I appreciate all the love. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Revival Lifestyle Podcast. If you like what you heard, go to www.isaiahsaldivar.com for more content. And please follow me on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram at Isaiah Saldivar. See you next week.